No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
Good evening. That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. Good evening, Maria. How are you?
Good afternoon, Senator. Yeah, and you know, today, the day that we move our clocks forward is probably the most special day in my life. I kid you not, because I know that that means spring is here. And so today and tomorrow are the longest days of daylight that we're going to experience. So these are good times, except for we're sweltering with triple degree temperatures for days on end. And I feel so badly. I have the thermostat. I go between 78 and 79 degrees, and I refuse to have it on at night and won't run large appliances and all of that stuff. Like, I ran the dishwasher last night after midnight because it, you know, there's only so much energy. There's a finite amount.
Yeah.
And we live in a very populous community. And I hear Texas is having their own challenges again. So, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, let's remind all those people on Capitol Hill who 20 years ago laughed at the idea of global warming. You know, it's just horrible from what we hear. One of the nice things about living in Washington, D.C. is that the climate's pretty moderate. We do get some hot weather from time to time. Triple digit temperature is almost unheard of. We've had one earthquake in the past 100 years, I think. We don't have any tornadoes, a rare hurricane. I mean, we're right in the middle of the country. So in terms of going, we're right in the middle of the East Coast, rather. And we're pretty lucky in that respect.
But you know what about the climate change thing?
Yeah.
You know, I know people say that, you know, there's 100-year cycles and et cetera, et cetera. But right. Even on a small scale, I have three citrus trees. Two of them blossomed, all of the blossoms fell off. The third is over 20 years old, produces a copious amounts of lemons, such that I made limoncello during COVID last year, two huge bottles of it. And then I would squeeze the juice from the lemons and put it into ice cube trays to take advantage of it. There's not one single blossom on all three of those trees. And yeah. Nothing has changed. The environment is the same. I water it the same. I fertilize it the same. And it is not producing fruit for the first time this year. And I'm like, if that doesn't say something about climate change, I don't know what does.
Yeah. And I mean, just look, you know, we've got things going on like icebergs the size of a state breaking off after hundreds of years. And this is really something. I don't think that a lot of people understand how fragile the environment is and how raising the water table by a foot or two would be just devastating in some parts of the world. You'd have to, you know, parts of Florida and Louisiana and Texas, maybe
and California.
Yeah.
And everybody on the coast.
Right, would have to put up dikes. It'd be like, to keep the water out. Yeah, or be on stilts. But, it's really a problem. And it's one of the many problems. You know, My grandmother used to say, be careful what you wish for. And I think that when I think of President Biden these days, he's got a lot of problems to deal with. And, of course, all the people that come behind him will have them, too. Not only climate change, but gun violence in America. You know, we're seeing more and more of this. I don't know what's going on in L.A., but in Washington, murders are up by 35% in the District of Columbia. And we've just had some hideous crimes, like that little boy that was shot on the L.A. freeway.
Yeah.
And it looks like because his mother cut somebody off in traffic or something. And
I think what happened is she got cut off and she used a hand gesture is what they say. So I'm assuming flipping the finger.
Yeah.
And then the 23-year-old young man shot at her car and killed her 6-year-old son in the back seat in his car seat.
Yeah. Because he, you know, some people are mindless. I bet he never meant to kill anybody. I bet he was just pissed and he was going to put a bullet in her car and show her who the boss was. And, you know, but that's one of the reasons you got to get the guns out of hands of dangerous people. Not out
but
of
you know what's the hands, problem, though, Michael?
What?
Law-abiding citizens get guns and then can turn into problems with either mental health issues or anger issues or... I mean, I know that we've spoken about this. My dad was a staunch NRA. My dad went to a military academy for high school and was a sharpshooter. Uh-huh. He was born and raised in Chicago, first generation. And he used to travel to high school on a bus with his gun with him.
Yeah, there are people in D.C. that you should do the same thing.
And you think about doing that now, but of course not. But my dad used the gun not for harm, but he was a hunter. So it was for animals, which I also still have a little bit of a problem with, but because I think that's not really fair. It's different if you do a bow and arrow, maybe, you know, or you run after the animal with a knife. Maybe it's a little more fair, but not with a gun, but still.
Not catching a deer.
Yeah, exactly. With a knife. So and he used to bring home whatever he, you know, killed him, cut it up, butcher it, and we'd eat it, and et cetera. But when he took us out target practice once, me and my sibs, and he... you know, knocked off a couple of doves as in flight and they fell to the ground. And as they were dying, the four of us were sobbing around the dead bird. And that was the last time my dad went hunting.
Yeah.
He was like, I don't think this is so much fun anymore.
Yeah.
The kids are reacting way too violently.
Well, and you know what? I don't think that most people in America have a problem with gun ownership. And another thing is, we understand that it's not the only problem of what's going on now. Is not the only problem is not the ownership of guns. There were plenty of guns around when I was a kid, and you never saw any of this. Never saw any of this.
Yeah.
Nobody walked into a shopping center and just randomly killed people. Or you know, there's always been violence and. And, you know, I've even heard people say, I grew up in North New Jersey, where the mafia, not so much when I was a kid, but when my parents were kids in my city, the mafia ran everything. And, you know, people would say it was safer because it was controlled violence, you know, right? Yeah. They targeted people and they only messed with you if they had a problem with you. And otherwise, this was my Italian grandmother thought that these guys kept the neighborhood safe. I'm not sure I agree with that, but yeah, things have definitely changed. I always had access to guns. You know, I never would have thought of like shooting people because some girl didn't go to the prom with me or somebody had, you know, I had some other teenage angst problem or, you know, and I'll be honest with you. And this is a problem with young people. I carried a gun when I was young. I carried a handgun. Illegal.
Really?
Illegal handgun, yeah, for a brief period of time, until I got in a jam one night, and I got pushed up against the wall, and it was, you know, as they say, fish or cut bait time, and I actually pulled the gun, and the person backed down, But the next day, I took the gun and I threw it in the river because I said to myself, how would this have been a good outcome?
Would it have been good for you?
Would it have been a good outcome if I had shot this person and spent the rest of my life in jail?
Right.
Would it have been a good outcome if I didn't shoot him and he shot me? And so I said, I realized at that point a gun, which I thought empowered me because I was in the world alone and I was 17 years old. I thought, you know, this gun that empowered me really didn't empower me at all. It actually made me much more vulnerable. So I got rid of it, and I've never owned one since.
And I've never owned one. I've never even had possession of one. My dad's collection is still alive and well with my mom and their home, which it always was when we were growing up, but that was the extent of it. They were for him, not for us. We were all clear with that.
Well, and you know what? My mother made, after the Second World War, veterans were allowed to keep their service weapons. And my mother made my father get rid of all of his because there was a rash of children that were being hurt with these weapons. You know, you can imagine how many men fought in the Second World War that, you know, there were kids that were getting into their dad's guns and getting hurt. And my mother said, absolutely not. No guns in my house. No, you know, which I understand because my father had an antique pistol, a six shooter, which you had to load with balls and, you know, wadding and the whole thing. So it wasn't actually functional for us, but it was an antique and it was worth a lot of money. And they used to hide it. And every time they hit it, I found it because I had more time to look for it than they had.
Oh, my goodness.
And I remember as a little boy, I mean, 7, 8 years old, standing in front of a mirror with the gun in my waistband and pulling it out. And playing like I was, you know,
Cowboy.
Sin, right, or you know, Have Gun Will Travel, or you know, one of the TV.
Wow.
You know? And so when I started to have children, I said, yeah, you can't. And I don't know, you know, there's also something about culture because little boys, when I was a kid, every little boy had a toy gun. Every little boy, never met a little boy that didn't have a toy gun. And it really was a boy thing. It wasn't so much a girl thing.
Well, I remember my brothers having the cap guns.
Right. We have them.
But I never, ever bought my children, my son's guns. Mm-hmm. And you know what they used was toilet paper rolls and paper towel rolls.
Right, because you can't
And they
stop
would
them.
Shoot that at each other. And I was like, where did you get that? It didn't come from the TV shows you watch, and it didn't come from the pop guns that you don't have. But somehow they figured it out. And it's toilet paper roll.
Well, and let me tell you, I was infuriated a few years ago when I heard that some little boy was being reprimanded and like suspended for 3 days from school because he made a gun with his fingers. And he pointed
at
somebody. You know, he stuck out his index finger and pulled up his thumb. And I'm like, you can't stop little boys from doing something like that. You know, it's just crazy. But, you know, and I understand that, you know, we want to be nonviolent, of course. But, I mean, come on, you know, we don't need to get crazy about it. And I don't know, this is somewhat of a rough segue, but
I was going to say, what trouble have you caused lately?
Right. And this
the little boy who grew into the big boy.
I'm telling you that, you know, I have to be honest, and I spend a lot of time talking about how I don't like what the Republicans are doing. But now I'm in a knockdown, drag-out fight with the Democrats. And you know, you've heard me say this many times on the show that we need two strong parties in America.
Yes,
and let me also tell you that the basic nature of Democratic politicians and Republican politicians is very much the same. The agenda is different, but the people themselves are very much the same. And you always have to keep that in mind. You know, it's not...
And the personality profile.
Right. And, you know, and the world, believe me, I've been a Democrat since I was a baby, I think. And the world would not be a better place if it were run completely by Democrats any more than it would be if it were run completely by Republicans. We need two healthy parties. So right now, I'm in a drag out, knockdown fight with the senator from Michigan's staff, Gary Peters. Gary Peters is going to have a hearing on Tuesday, before this coming Tuesday, before the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs, of which he is chairman. And the hearing is about D.C. statehood. It's for our bill that now sits before the United States Senate, the D.C., the Washington, D.C. Admission Act, S-51, which is companion legislation to a bill that passed earlier this year for the second time in the House of Representatives that would make the District of Columbia state. So this is the mandate that created my office. The mandate that created my office says that my responsibility as a senator for the District of Columbia is to keep Congress informed of our readiness and our qualification for statehood, that we've met all the requirements and that we want statehood and we're ready for it. And my job is to keep Congress, individual congressmen informed of that, and Congress as a whole informed with that, and to be a liaison and bring information on our progress to the citizens of the District of Columbia, and also to advise them on matters of public policy that impact on the issue of statehood. Now, the hearing that's being conducted on Tuesday is actually before a congressional committee in the Senate, and it's all about statehood. It's all about D.C. statehood, and it's all about whether we're qualified for statehood. I mean, if you wrote my mandate after you heard what the hearing was about, it would perfectly fit. You know what
I'm saying? Of course.
Yeah.
Well, and who better qualified than you?
Well, I don't know if I'm better qualified, but I was elected by the people to do it, whether I'm qualified or not. And so I went, and they won't let me testify. They absolutely won't let me testify.
It is obscene.
It really
is. That's the case.
And my colleague, they won't let either one of us testify. So I called the best part is they don't even inform us that they're having a hearing.
Yeah.
They don't return any of our phone calls. Karen, my chief of staff, and I reached out to them 7 times before they returned a phone call. And they only returned the phone call when I finally said to the receptionist, a really nice young man, last week, that like on Tuesday or Wednesday of last week, I said, look, you need to let the senator know that I'm not going to let this stand, and that somebody needs to talk to me or there's going to be trouble. Mm-hmm. I'm just telling you. I mean, I want to give you a heads up. I'm a Democrat. I care about statehood. I don't want to interfere with your hearing, but I'm not going to allow this to stand. And at that point, his staff called me. And they set up a Zoom meeting. So we had a Zoom meeting. They were condescending from the minute they got on. Well, first of all, they called me Mr. Brown, Mr. Brown, Mr. Brown. Mm. Now that may seem like a little thing, mm-hmm. I feel petty bringing it up, to be honest with you. But you know what? I've known 100 congressional staffers. 100 congressional staffers, and there's not one of them ever that would think to call a senator anything but senator, even a retired senator. They would never think to call him. anything else. And so they started out by saying, you really don't count, you know, and they did that by saying, Mr. Brown, Mr. Brown, Mr. Brown. And then they talked down to me and explained to me their strategy. Mm. And this is their strategy. There's a new rule in the United States Senate because of the nature of the Senate, that it's split right down the middle, 50-50, that the majority party, I'm sorry, the minority party on the committee, as you may know, I don't know if our listeners know this, but when the Democrats are in majority, which they really are right now, even though we're split, they get control of every committee. When the Republicans have the majority, then they get control of every committee. So the deal is that the majority party, the Democrats, get to call as many witnesses as they want, and the minority party can only call one less witness. So the Democrats have 10 witnesses, the Republicans can call 9 witnesses. If the Democrats have 2 witnesses, the Republicans can call 1 witness. That's what they're saying. And they have 3 witnesses set up, I'm sorry, 4 witnesses to talk, because they want to limit what the Republicans can say in the hearing by only allowing them 3 witnesses. Mm. And they're afraid if they have more witnesses, then the Republicans could call more witnesses, and that might rebut their testimony. What? Really? You're going to hide? You know, you really got, we're going to limit you to 3 witnesses because you don't want, we don't want you to tell us we're wrong. Well, that's a hell of a debate, isn't it? You know? So here's how it's going to go. They have a witness from the Cato Institute, which a guy that appeared on our show. I don't know if you remember this guy, Roger Pilon. He is going to testify that statehood is unconstitutional.
Oh boy.
Then, so the Democrats have produced a witness from the University of Michigan Law School. And I'll bet you he's going to say that statehood is constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Republicans have produced a witness from the University of Iowa who's going to say that the city is not physically capable of supporting statehood, that we're not physically solvent.
This isn't the one with the bowling alleys and the movie theaters. Physically.
No.
Okay.
This is a college professor. It was a congressman in the House that said that. But that we're physically, you know, incapable of sustaining statehood. Then the mayor, who is a witness, and you know, I'd love to point this out, got less votes than I did in the last election. The mayor is going to say, no, we are fiscally responsible. And she's going to give us all the great statistics that prove that we're fiscally responsible. And then there's a guy from the Urban League that's going to be the last witness, and he's going to say it's unjust and unfair. Now, how do I know this? Because this is what we've been saying for years, and it doesn't get us anywhere. And the truth of the matter is, Maria, the Republicans don't care about the constitutionality of our legislation. They don't care whether we're fiscally solvent or not. They really don't care about the 23rd Amendment and how that might play if we get statehood, if we don't resolve it. What they care about is 2 more Democrats, and we're not addressing that, and we should be addressing it. And you know what? This is something that's gone on with every state that's ever entered the union. It's always been a political battle over what party they assume will be in power. With North Dakota and South Dakota, that was supposed to be one state called Dakota. They split it down the middle because the Republicans wanted 4 senators. and they thought for sure that the Dakotas would pass, would elect four Republicans, which they absolutely did. But you know, some of the most liberal Democrats have also come from the Dakotas. So you know that changes over time, but that's always been the battle, and that's what we need to talk about. And we're not talking about it. We're talking about the same old, going down a rabbit hole. And you brought up the car dealership. That's a perfect example. We have some guy in the stand up in Congress and say, "You can't be a state. You don't have any car dealerships." So what do? DC Vote, which is our local advocacy group for statehood, they hold a rally at the car dealership to prove we do have a car dealership. Instead of saying, what the hell difference does it make if we have a car dealership?
Dealership or not.
Yeah. You know that 45 states came into the union without a car. He also said we don't have an airport. 45 states came into the union without a car dealership, including California, or an airport, including California, because, and I know this, because when California and the other 44 states came into the union, the automobile and the airplane had yet to be invented.
The facts.
Yeah, one of the 13 colonies, they opened up airports just in case, you know. I mean, it's crazy talk, and we go down the rabbit hole each time with them. You know, we
so, don't. But,
yeah, go ahead.
But you suggested when we spoke yesterday, which I did do, and I want the listeners to get a pen and paper and write down this number, because you're going to share with them what number to call to register your displeasure with the fact that Senator Michael D. Brown is not allowed to testify at the hearing on June 22nd. And of course, I called them. And fortunately got the outgoing message that, you know, because it was yesterday afternoon. And my message was, because they asked for your name, your phone number, your email, and what it is that you had to say. And I said, my name is Maria Sanchez. I live in Los Angeles County, California. I am a registered Republican. And I think it's unconscionable that you do not have Senator Michael D. Brown on your agenda on Tuesday, June 22nd. I am DC for statehood. And I believe that it is imperative that you put him on your agenda. And here's my phone number and here's my email. So I'd be real curious to see what comes of that, because I'm sure they don't get very many calls from Republicans from California talking about DC for statehood.
Well, you know, absolutely. And we hope that Iowans for DC statehood and some of the other groups around the country have called. But yes, if you have a pen and a paper, the number, and we'll post it on my Facebook page, it's posted there on Twitter and other places, is 202-224-2627. And we hope you'll call. If it's just simply to say, let the senator speak, if that's all you have to say. And, you know, the good news, Maria, is we shut down the message service. You can't leave a message anymore because we filled up their mailbox.
To
capacity, right. So we're asking people to start calling tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., even if you've called already. Call again and, you know, let's torture this nice young man who answers the phone for them. And maybe they'll see, you know, he's the only one that's been nice on their staff. Look, their staff was so condescending in explaining this us. And this is the point. You can't seek justice if you can't practice justice. Mm-hmm. You can't seek a resolution to a bad problem by being bad. You know, the Dr. King used to say that the old standard of an eye for an eye leaves everyone blind. And that's what's happening here. These guys can't see, in my humble opinion, can't see the forest for the trees. And the solution, the way to get DC statehood, make it happen in Congress, is very, very straightforward. It's not easy. It's a very difficult path, but it's very straightforward. The first thing you have to do is you have to remember, you have to remind Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia that he is a Democrat. And if they can't, and if you can't figure that out, you need to sanction him. The Republicans sanction people. They sanction people that are outrageous, like
Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yeah, Marjorie Taylor Greene, right, from Georgia. So let's let's be honest again. How much do we criticize the Republican Party for not standing up to Donald Trump? Meanwhile, we let Joe Manchin be a bully that none of us is willing to stand up to because he's a Democrat.
Yeah, I don't get, every time I see his picture and his name, I think, how did that guy from that teeny tiny state get this much power? What happened?
And that's the whole thing.
What happened?
What happened is the country became divided right down the middle, and he's decided to straddle both sides. You know, he's got one foot on the platform and one foot on the train, as we say. And that's why he's getting all the attention, because he's the only Democrat out there. You have other Democrats. You have one or two other Democrats that aren't on the bill, like Sinema of Arizona. But they're not like Manchin. She's not out there saying, you know, I'm going to be a bipartisan. I'm going to make everything happen, you know, and I'm not going to be, you know, a traditional Democrat and just take the sides of the Democrats. That's Joe Manchin. And, you know, Joe Manchin just negotiated a compromise with the Republicans Joe Biden's infrastructure bill, mm-hmm. and the Republicans backed out of all of it. So he's not doing it. You know what I mean? He says he's doing it, yep. but the Republicans didn't support his modifications, and neither did the Democrats. So all he's doing is getting more and more attention, and we're trying to work on that. We're trying to, because West Virginia is a place that we can all drive to here in Washington. It's an hour away from my home. We're talking about things that we can do. There's a bunch of African Americans who have organized and had protests this weekend. Actually, they're here in Washington, but during the week they were protesting in West Virginia because Joe Manchin is constantly saying, I represent the people of West Virginia, and these people are saying, well, he doesn't represent us.
Right.
You know, the things coming out of his mouth do not, you know, reflect what we think. You know, there may be some constituents, but I think the things are starting to turn. But the first thing we need to do is we need to get him out of the way. We need to get him to fall in line, because this is as basic as it gets to democracy. We can never forget that we're the only democracy in the world that does this. So we need to get him in line. I think if we do, Senator Sinema will, she won't be the only one standing out there with her face hanging out, the only Democrat, and she'll fall in line. And then we have enough votes with Kamala Harris, Vice President Harris, who's a strong supporter of D.C. statehood. She was a co-sponsor of our bill and has always been outspoken on the issue. We can pass it if we can suspend the rule. And the rule is the filibuster, or what's been called cloture. Now, look, if you can't suspend the rule for something as basic as enfranchising 700,000 loyal citizens, then you can't suspend the rule for anything. The rule's been suspended twice to get Supreme Court nominees nominated. But if you can't suspend it for something as basic to our democracy as the right to representation, which Thomas Jefferson said was the single most basic right of citizenship, if you can't do it for that, then it's not a tool for our democracy. It's a tool for tyranny. It's just used to be tyrannical. And that's something that I think all our listeners have to understand, is that it is nothing more than a rule. There's nothing about a majority, you know, a supermajority in the Constitution. There's nothing. It was a rule that was brought up by Aaron Burr.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, the horrible man that shot Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Killed.
Yeah.
And, Thomas Jefferson.
And, yeah, and then Alexander Hamilton. But anyway, you know, while he was singing, he shot him, you know. But anyway, you know, it's a rule. And it was hardly ever used until the Jim Crow era. And it's, you know, we probably need to get rid of it. But even if we don't get rid of it, we need to at least suspend it in severe, you know, we always say it, there's an exception to every rule. And if there's not an exception, any exception to a rule, it's just a tool of tyranny. It's not a rule that can be helpful to our democracy. So if we can get Joe Manchin in line and we can get we can suspend the rule, then we can pass D.C. statehood. Otherwise, it's not going to happen, because in 220 years, right? Is that right? Yes. 220 years, there's only been one Republican that ever voted for statehood, and he was on our show, Congressman Wayne Gilchrist. Do you remember this lovely guy who now works on keeping the Chesapeake Bay clean, you know, and I don't know how old he is, but he's up there in years, and he was just the loveliest guest. But he's the only person in 220 years in the Republican Party that's voted for D.C. statehood. So they're not going to get 10 Republicans. Not on, you know, it's more likely that God will come down and declare D.C. a state, then they'll get 10 Republicans. So they're barking up the wrong tree. They really need to, you know, and this is testimony that I intended to give. And I will. I'll put it out somewhere on the internet and other places if they won't let me do it in front of in front of the committee. And let me also say, Maria, and this is big news for me. I wanted to start, I said, I know what the testimony is going to be, constitutional, not constitutional, not solvent, yes, we're solvent, blah, blah, blah. Somebody has to speak to this on a level that deals with our democracy. So I went and I paid a guy a few weeks ago, or about 10 days ago, go search my lineage.
You didn't do one of the sites?
No, I went to.
And why is that?
I went to a group because I was coming up before the Senate, I thought, perhaps, and I didn't think that I had enough time or expertise to get it done quick. So I hired a lovely man from a group called Sons of the American Revolution. Oh. And they traced my lineage directly back to a patriot who, at 17 years old, enlisted in the Continental Army and later became a doctor, the first doctor in a city in New York, in the state of New York. And it's funny, it must have been a town in those days, because I looked it up and the population is only 2,000 today. So, but anyway, he became their first doctor. And it's funny, this is perfect, Maria. You know, he's telling me about this guy, and whose name was Joel Prescott, and Dr. Joel Prescott. And I said, oh, well, he was a doctor, so that means he was an officer. And the guy said, no, he was a private. He didn't become a doctor. I didn't know how old he was. He didn't become a doctor until after the war. And I go, oh, that's just our luck, a private. But anyway, that's how I expected this.
He's still a patriot.
That's right. And I expected, and I am now a son of the American Revolution. But I expected to start my testimony to say, you know, that I'm here to represent the 700,000 people that elected me, but also to represent him. because he's put his life, liberty, and property on the line 250 years ago, basically, and today, so that he could secure the blessings of liberty for himself and his posterity. But unfortunately, they haven't been passed on to his posterity, and they haven't been passed on to my, right, because I don't have the rights he fought for. So, and I'm his, I am in fact his great, 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 great grandson. I'm his direct descendant. And then I was going to end by saying, look, Dr. Prescott spent his life healing people. Mm-hmm. That's what he was. He was a healer. But when it was time to fight, he stood up and fought because he knew that to everything, there's a season and a purpose to every, you know, thing under heaven. And sometimes you have to fight. And now is the time for the people of D.C. to fight. You know, Dr. King, we try to negotiate. The Republicans have started a fight with us, and we're trying to negotiate. Well, Dr. King didn't go to the Pettus Bridge and say, hey, can we get across the bridge and work something out here? No, he said, we're not going to put up with this anymore. We have a caller named David.
Let's take one. Sure.
Yeah. David, are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Michael. This is David and Lana from Australia.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Wow. Hello.
Yes, we're doing really well. Love your show and your topics, and you're so inspirational. Really enjoy listening to you.
Thanks.
And thought I'd just drop in and say hello. I hope everything's going well in D.C. We've been wanting to speak to you for quite a while.
Yeah,
That's so sweet of you.
Yeah,
wow.
Very sweet. And you know what? Things aren't going so well. We're in a fight, but that's all right because I'm from I'm from North New Jersey, which has a reputation
right.
of one of the toughest towns in Washington. You know, people, David, called me at one point when people on a listserv were saying terrible things about me, and they said that's horrible, and they did what you just did. They said very nice things and how I should stay the course and stuff. And I said to them, I'm from an Italian family. People in my family have said worse things about me than these people are saying. So I appreciate that. And how are you and Lana? You're doing well.
Yeah, no, you've got the fighting spirit in you. I love it. We're doing really well. We have been quite busy on our end here in Australia, just trying to get things going with our projects, moving right along. Universal Soul Love, lots of other things going on. Too much to talk about right now.
We'll have you back on the show to talk about it sometime in the future. And let me tell you, coming to Australia is on my bucket list. You know, went to India. I went to India in 2019, and the only downside to the trip was as an old man sitting on the plane for that long. But if I can muster the strength someday, I would love to come. I actually went to a conference and spent a weekend with a member of parliament from New Zealand. He was a Maori. And those are the two places I'd really love to see. I'd love to see New Zealand. I'd love to see Australia. I can tell you that I have met many Australians in my travels in life, in London and Hawaii and other places. I've met Australians, and I've never, ever, ever once met an Australian that I didn't like.
Yeah.
They're just...
Well, the down under.
They're wonderful people. It's a great place. People are great here. I found that Australians actually know more about the United States than I do, because when they go to the United States, they tend to travel everywhere, and they become really knowledgeable before they go on their trips. And
isn't that
amazing what they know about the U.S.?
Uh-huh.
Well, I got to tell you, David, and this is absolutely confidential. You cannot tell anybody this, but every Australian that I think I've ever met, I partied with. And they also love to party. So I've had a lot of good times with Australians.
They are known for their enjoyment of libations.
Yeah, and you know what?
Well, I'm having my fun.
Well, and you know what? That spirit that they have is infectious. You know, when they go out and they do party, you understand that these are people that are out to have fun and enjoy other people. You know, they're not aggressive. They're not, you know, they're not mean.
Everyone's friendly here.
Everybody's friendly. Yeah, they're wonderful people. I can't say enough about them. And I'll tell you a funny story. I went around London one time with an Australian, and everywhere we went, we were very young, and everywhere we went, the British would say to him, now the Australians and the Brits sounded pretty much the same to me, but everywhere we went, people would say to them, and I don't know if this was to be insulting or what, but they'd look at my friend and they'd go, so you're from America too? He'd go, yeah, I'm from Australia. And they go, you know, like they thought his accent and my accent were the same, but I never could figure out whether they were just trying to talk down to him
or what they were doing.
I think from an American or what, but I always remember that. And he was a lovely man. Yeah.
Everyone here thinks I'm from Canada.
Yeah.
Oh,
there you go. That's funny. And we have so many accents in America, States.
Here in Australia, they call everyone Yankees. And I go, well, you wouldn't call the Southerners Yankees. They might get insulted by that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because they haven't figured out yet, David, that the Civil War is actually over. They think it's, you know, it's
still waving the Confederate flag.
Yeah, unfortunately, they are. And I'll tell you a story that my sister-in-law is related, a direct descendant of one of the most famous Confederate soldiers, a guy named Pickett, who did a thing called Pickett's Charge at the Battle of Gettysburg. But my brother was an Air Force pilot stationed in Alabama, and she was a bank teller. You know, she got this job to help supplement their income, and there were people that wouldn't even deal with her. They wouldn't give her their deposits or, you know, because she was a Northerner, and they would always call her the Yankee lady, and it pissed her off. She'd go, I'm the great-great-granddaughter of General Pickett, damn it, you know, but that's okay. She grew up in Maryland, and that was
never you mind.
Right, that was far enough north for those people, so they're still fighting the war down there. But thanks so much for calling in.
That's fine. I was just calling in to see if our friends Doug and Don could arrange the video recording that I want to do with you and Sasha Stone and David Gallup and a couple of others, possibly Michael Pellinger. And when I called in, he said, "Hello, Shadow Politics." And I said, "Oh, you're on the air right now." And he So Don said, the producer said, do you want me to patch you in? I said, I guess so. I don't know what the topic is, but I guess I can just think on my feet and try to say something appropriate. I hope I didn't take you off topic.
No, the topic is I'm getting kicked around, David, and that is my, unfortunately, my modus operandi here. I'm kind of the soccer ball of Democratic politics in Washington. But I'm sure that Don can arrange that, and I'd be happy to do it anytime. You guys are great guys, and the two of you have been very supportive, and we like it, and we like your show, and I've been on before, and I'd love to do it again.
And I think unfortunately, it's we haven't been working. Yep.
Are doing. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate that. We haven't been running the show for a while now. It's just been a little bit too much work with our workload to run the radio show. But we're still very active with people and with our projects. But we did enjoy doing that show for 4 years. We'd love to get back into it if we had the support for it, but in any case, we're still connected to everyone, and we do these things occasionally. So our show is going to be on trying to achieve global peace, which should be interesting.
Wow.
I'm sure a lot to say about that. We're trying to keep this in the positive. Difficult time for a difficult topic.
True.
Well, but the technology that's available now, I think, has great potential to bring us closer and closer. You know, so I think you're doing it at the right time. Unfortunately, our show's almost over here, so I have to say goodbye that we can wrap up.
Okay.
But I appreciate you calling in, and I appreciate that you want global peace, because, you know, I think I can speak for Maria and I to say that we support that idea.
True.
We'd like to see global peace too. So thank you. All our best to Lana, and we'll talk again soon, I hope.
Excellent. Thanks to both of you. Okay. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Have a good,
Take
have
good
a good
care.
Thank you.
Right,
Take care. Bye.
So, Maria, any last thing you want to say?
You know what the one thing is, and I don't know what you feel about this, about the Roman Catholic bishops in the United States and the warning to President Biden about his stance on abortion and receiving the sacrament of communion. I think that's a real terrible play. And apparently the Vatican told them don't, and they did it anyway.
Well, you know, Maria, this is one of the two reasons that I became an Episcopal.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important reason was that my wife was baptized in an Episcopal when she was like 30. And she,
oh, really?
Yeah, and she started going to Episcopal church, which I refused to go to. I hadn't been to church in 25 years because I'd fallen out with the Catholics. And one day she was sick. She wasn't feeling well. She had the flu or something. And she said to the children, "We're not going to church." And my kids flipped out. Now, my kids were like 7, 5, and 3 at the time. And all three of them were like walking around and crying, going, "I can't believe we're not going to church." And I couldn't believe that. It stunned me. I'm like, really? They want to go to church?
Mm-hmm.
I had to go check this place out. And when I went and checked it out, I found that the church I went to, which was very small and people were very well connected, was so much different than the Catholics because they weren't tied to those strict rules. You know, things like a woman, when I was a kid, a woman could never be on the altar of a Catholic church unless she was getting married. She couldn't be an altar, you know, an attendant. She couldn't, you know, give sacraments. She couldn't. You know, that's changed over the years, of course. But this strict adherence to those kind of rules,
It's troubling. It's, you know, I get troubled now being a Republican and being a Catholic, a Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I know change is inevitable, and maybe this is a time for change for me in those profound ways. But I've always said to my Democrat friends, you know, the Republican Party needs somebody on the left side of the tent with their foot outside of the tent to pull them away from the right wing stuff and get the Republicans more moderate. And I think that about Catholicism. We went to Mass yesterday. It was the first time they had Saturday Mass with, you know, no restrictions and everything. And the priest, Monsignor, was so grateful to be there. He must have said it 6 times. It is so good to be back and to see you and stuff. And I was like, wow, that was palpable, that he was really, really, really happy to be there. And that made me feel so good because we were really, really, really happy to be there, too. But, yeah, it's troubling to me that, I mean, I'm divorced and was married in the Catholic Church. And so I often wondered, was I ever going to be denied communion, you know, post-divorce?
Right.
And
right.
Fortunately, no priest ever did that to me, even though they knew my circumstances. But I can't imagine if they would do it to President Biden.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're going to have to leave it on that note because we're out of time. But We should do a show on it. We really should. We should have somebody on and talk about this issue. And I'm going to leave you with one thing that I think will make you chuckle, is that when I became Episcopal, my brother called me, who's still a Roman Catholic, and he said, when are you going to get your kids out of that cult religion? And I said to him, you know, after 400 years, I'm not sure you could still refer to it as a cult religion. But, and my church was so old-fashioned, which just shows you that you can have these traditions and still be very liberal and still be very accepting. It was, you know, never in my church did I ever see a boy above the age of 5 that didn't have a tie on. People used to dress up. We used, it was more like a Catholic mass from when I was a kid than Catholic masses are today. But anyway, we'll talk about it another time. Thanks for tuning in.
Good luck. One last phone number.
Yeah, 202-224-2627. If you have time tomorrow, please call and say, let the senator speak. Happy Father's Day to everybody out there. And you know what? All the dads out there, I've taken the liberty of choosing a song and dedicating it to myself. Here's Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers with Won't Back Down. Thanks, folks. See you next week.